So, think we can start. Cordial welcome to all the people that have made it here. Although we have ghastly conditions outside, well, it's really hard. 8:15 in the morning, heavy rains. So a cordial welcome to all the people that listen to this in the quiet of their apartments on the broadcasting devices. So let's start. Okay, so yesterday we left off at this precise point, right? So what we talked about was, well, there was this parallel between games and social media. Then yesterday we were still concerned with trying to come up with classification schemas for social media characteristics. And one important subclass of social media was social networking, and among that a subclass was mobile social networking. And that was particularly interesting because of that context point of view, right? So we had sensors, models, and usage of the model instances, especially individual context and social context. And among social contexts, we said, okay, what is social context? We were trying to model everything about social relations between users that had something to do with the interaction of those users with IT systems, okay? And that is a core thing about social gaming and social media, to make intelligent use of those social contexts, right? And social contexts are also present in the non-mobile case, obviously, especially those long-term social contexts, right? And that's what what we will be looking at for the coming lectures, and that's obviously social networks, right? So social relations give rise to the idea of models of those, and we will see that those are social networks, of course, right? So long-term social context is something that we will look at, okay? Good. That is good. So a social network in that view would be an instance of a social network model, which in most cases will be an undirected or directed graph, right? Now, this is a very simple model, obviously, right? Because we all know that although, well, people can be viewed as nodes, that's all right, but edges are usually directed, okay? Because, as you know from your personal relations, it's not always symmetric. If I like you, it's not clear that you like me back, right? At least not in the same intensity, okay? So this is a very, very simple model, right? Undirected edges. The question is, can we pimp that a little bit, right? So this would be something like a more refined model, right? So we don't need to use that all the time. However, one thing is clear, so we still have the nodes, we still have the edges, but certainly we want to say more about the nodes than that they are just there and that they have some ID, right? So speaking of social media, one interesting characteristic of almost all social media classes that we discussed is profiles, right? For self-disclosure models of yourself, mostly in the form of attribute value pairs, but containing a lot of interesting data structures. Your likes, your ratings, your names, your contacts can also be subsumed under your profile, right? So it's certainly nice to say nodes have profiles. Well, and in those profiles would be a more mathematical version of those profiles that you have, for example, on Facebook. Yeah? And if you, for example, if you state your interests, right? Interests are short phrases of texts separated by some comma or list characters. And naturally, which we will see, you can model text, for example, as word vectors, right? You count the words, you would then translate everything that is a textual representation into a mathematical representation, and that's what information retrieval, for example, does, right? One typical example for those that have heard that term and that concept is TF-IDF, term frequency times inverse document frequency, right? And other things are more easy to translate into a math representation, for example, the location, right? Location on the Earth's surface is spherical coordinates theta and phi in the form of long lat numbers, for example, right? That's why we want to associate with the nodes node profiles. However, the same is true for the edges as well, right? So one thing that we can do, which we will see in a second, is to state of which kind the relation is. What we can also do is to come up with a model of the strength of a relation that would correspond to a weight on the edges, right? So we can have one weight, several weights, and that we can subsume under edge profile, right? In the same fashion as we can partition the edges into sorts, right? Certain types of relations, we can also partition the set of actors into sorts, which would then give rise to so-called modes, right? So we have a one-mode network, which corresponds to just one sort of nodes, two modes, which correspond to two-mode networks, and so on, right? That would be a more fine-grained model, for example, right? Now, good. So, speaking of edge profiles, what can we do? So, first of all, we can try to divide the types of relations into sorts, okay? And that will correspond to a taxonomy of social relations, for example. And that taxonomy of social relations is, for example, realized in FOF, in this ontology of social relations and its sub-ontologies, right? So there is a large taxonomy of social relations. Kinship is a concept node, and among that is, for example, mother, daughter, sibling, cousin, and all these concepts, okay? Good. However, there's a large ontological modeling freedom that you have, and it's very hard to define precise semantics for those edges, right? And we tried that in our research. So we started off with why can't we have an ontology for social relations, okay? And it turns out that it's, well, for the brother, mother, daughter, father, these things are really easy to define. But for all the things that involve more complicated emotional structures, it becomes really hard to come up with a consistent ontology, and sociopsychology doesn't deliver anything like that out of the box, right? So they're not interested in a sense in defining that in such a precise way, right? So, and the question is, why is that the case, okay? Why is it so hard to come up with an ontology for social relations? And the answer is, that is deeply rooted in our socialization behavior, right? If you're a four-year-old, it's really easy to tell who's your best friend. So anyone that has children or is the godfather of children, as in my case, knows that for a four-year-old, it's always easy to tell who's your best friend in kindergarten. Okay, that changes every 2 weeks, but it's a distinct role. And, well, for a four-year-old, other social relations are also easy to demarcate. Who's your mother? Okay, every four-year-old can tell you that. But if we grow up, things become more complicated. Things become more intricate. And, you know, it is very, very hard for you to explicitly state the ontological quality of your social relations once you grow up. And the reason for that is that we as social beings are very dependent on social relations. Now that seems a bit contradictory, because when we're so dependent, why don't we make things more clear? Well, the answer is, it is a very complicated emotional mixture that we have. And everybody knows that questions like, do you really love me? And things like that cry for an explication, but often the answer is void, right? Because, or at least internally void, the spoken answer might be different from the internal representation, because things are so complicated. We're living in a landscape of chances and possibilities and ways to expand or reduce relations. That's a constant mixture, a constant mud in a way, right? And Gottlieb Bossert, who worked with us a few years ago, came up with an interesting thesis which elaborated more on the socio-psychological reasons why explicit ontologies are so hard to come by, right? Which made us switch to another representation, because we thought, well, if it's not as easy to come up with a ontology, why don't we try to characterize social relations with respect to their qualities, right? So we tried to come up with an axis system. And there is a lot of axes that lend themselves well to characterizing social relations. One would be intensity, right? So intensity is comparatively easy to measure. So how often do you meet someone, right? This is one way to measure intensity. But as you can see, you're running into problems again. Is it emotional intensity, or is it intensity of practice? What do you mean by intensity? And there is a famous paper by Gilbert and Karahelios, I think the guy's called, and they make a lot of efforts to describe ways to come up with estimations for all those edges from social media, right? So intensity could, for example, be measured by the frequency of message exchange. It could also be measured by the reciprocity in a sense of message exchange, right? Because that again corresponds to directed and undirected. Yeah, you could also measure that, for example, by the response time. So if I react to your message within a time frame of 10 seconds every time, it's very likely that I'm more intensely related to you than in contrast to reacting only 5 days after your message, right? So there's a lot of these pragmatics to measure that. Well, second axis could be valence, which means, is the relation positively loaded or negatively loaded? And here you see, for example, some relations on a intensity valence diagram. So if the valence is very positive and the intensity is very positive, that would correspond to hot love, right? Whereas if the valence is very negative and the intensity is high, that would correspond to hot hate, yeah? So enemies. And there are other axes, like how hierarchical is the nature of the relation, reciprocity, intimacy, and so on. Again, it turns out that, for example, if you want to estimate the valence of a relation from social media, you're having a hard time, okay? Because what you need, technically, is sentiment analysis, right? Sentiment analysis is the field in social computing or informatics which deals with deriving a sentiment that is a valence, for example, from text or audio or even video, right? And deriving a sentiment from text is surprisingly complicated, obviously, right? Because you're having things such as irony, negation, and in practice, it's an AI hard problem. And we tried that to come up with a rough estimation of valence, but we didn't have very good results, right? So right now, a master's student of me is trying to tackle that with the latest methods, which I think, have evolved over the last years, but it's still a hard problem, right? So this is surprisingly hard, okay? Yeah? Basically, yeah. So his contribution was that there's basically two types that we can distinguish from text sentiment analysis: happy and unhappy. Right? It's more easy if you switch to richer media. So if you look at audio, a colleague of mine who's now working at Uni Passau is a well-known expert for audio-based emotion detection, and especially if you have video, right? So there is this this article in Der Spiegel of this week where they talk about this Egyptian-based company, I think, which does that very well. It depends on how good your labeled data is, right? So to build the classifiers is not so hard, in essence, right? Because you would just have to know what is the right set of features. And obviously in a face, as we will see, there is things that are called action units. So that correspond to little areas in your face that you can distinctly move. Obviously these are the things that give rise to why emoticons are so easy to build, yeah, because that, for example, your eyebrows consist of, I think, two or three of those action units, because we can switch the expression easily, as we know, by changing the eyebrows. Okay, that's easy, and these are things that you must be able to detect, for example, from video or images, while still allowing for some perspective distortion and so on. So these are basically, you can tackle all those problems if you have a data set that's large enough, right? So you need a lot of labeled data, and that's, I think, the main bottleneck for those things. However, it is a hard problem, okay? Good. So, now, this is maybe the three last slides for this slide set. Well, the question now is, so we've seen a lot about, well, games and media and networks and context and stuff, but do we really have an intuition about what the field of social computing now really does? Yeah? So if you were to explain to somebody what do you do in social computing? Well, it is still evolving, right? So if you're very generous, you can subsume the whole field of social signal processing under that. However, certainly machine learning is not a subfield of social computing, but increasingly so, the conferences tend to have at least one, two, or three tracks on machine learning-based social signal processing. So that's a clear part of this. Then we have social network analysis and other fields, but it's still fluffy. So what's to be subsumed under social computing, right? So in essence, social computing takes ideas from very many fields of computer science, right? And we should ask ourselves, when making an attempt to define what it actually is, how is the relation to, for example, peer-to-peer networking, right? So we've seen yesterday that the data silo problem gives rise to the idea of decentralized social networking, peer-to-peer social networking, for example. So if we want to distribute things, we need to make use of peer-to-peer techniques, right? Because that's obvious, right? So we need to be able to search in those networks. We need to be able to efficiently distribute data and stuff, right? If we take that idea seriously, we would even have to employ a lot of techniques for multi-agent systems, right? Because in essence, that's what your social agent is. It is an agent that has to negotiate, for example, with other agents to compose complex services, right? Which brings us into the whole field of distributed AI, even robotics, right? Which has a lot to do with these things. So robotics, again, has a lot of overlap in terms of, for example, emotion detection and emotion synthesis, right? Because all these efforts in Japan that are currently on the way to build real human-like robots need to make sure that those robots can detect emotion, but they must also be able to credibly synthesize emotion, right? Which you can also use, for example, when you design non-player characters in a social game, for example, or a shooter, right? And that's what we also work on, for example, in terms of what is an algebra for emotional interaction, right? So if both people are happy and one hits the other one with a club in the face, certainly the hitter may still be happy, but the other one will, for example, turn to sad, right? Depends, right? So who tells you that the other one will be sad? He could also be angry. So that's a degree of freedom of emotional algebraic interactions, which is also something that you need to be able to encode if you design games, or if you're into robotics, the robot must also credibly act and react, right? So social network analysis is, again, a subfield that we'll be concerned with, which opens the full spectrum of graph theory and everything that's going on there, right? So there's a lot of guys from Professor Meyer's chair who really deal with complicated graph theoretical problems. And for example, Hanjo Teubig, that you might know from GAD, he's working on social network analysis problems, albeit very much more complicated things than we do. However, that's also part of this in a sense, right? The whole stuff that has to do with web technology, rich web applications, and even it even goes into business. For example, the open innovation idea that I introduced, or company social networks, right? So it's a broad field. It's a field that spreads out its arms into very many fields of computer science and informatics, right? So social signal processing, we talked about, very heavy in social computing. It also has to do with game theory, auctions, and social choice. So that's more in the multi-agent logic domain, if you want. It has to do with information retrieval or information filtering, right? So the difference is information retrieval uses a query to come up with answers, while information filtering uses your profile as a query, right? So this is an ongoing filtering process. This has its relations to social computing in the form of social information retrieval, as we will see in the exercise. And of course, in information filtering, which has strong connections to collaborative filtering, which I introduced yesterday on the blackboard, and so on, right? It has a lot to do with privacy, so rule-based systems, because obviously social computing makes it necessary to open up your information space to a certain degree, while protecting other parts of it. So that makes it necessary to have an effective privacy concept, which most people find very unsexy, because that large screens of Facebook and all the other platforms where you can design all your access rules is something that nobody really would like to configure, right? That's why we are trying to come up with new UIs that answer those questions, right? So what is an easy way to come up with interesting privacy concepts? And one external PhD student of mine is currently working on probabilistic privacy concepts, right? So the question is, what are limits and chances of not having strict rules that exactly forbid someone to access something, but rather to have probabilistic classifier-based methods that would allow you to learn equivalence classes in the set of items to be protected, while at the same time trying to learn equivalence classes in the set of people that ask for those resources, right? So a typical requirement for privacy would be that please don't allow any company to access my drunkard party photos. Okay, good. So that's a reasonable requirement. But, well, what's a drunkard party photo? Can we learn that in any way from image features? What is the possible, probable degree of privacy of such an image? While that is, in essence, an AI hard problem, we can still try to come up with a rough estimate, for example, to build assistance systems for people to set their rule systems up, or to come up with choosing a pessimistic or an optimistic rule package that you can maybe buy from somewhere, right? And the same is true for asking about the equivalence classes in the domain of people, right? Which again brings us back to social contexts, right? So in essence, the rules would use parts of social context to say who's in a certain class, right? Then social semantic web is in there, which again opens up the door to classic symbolic AI. That is logic, right? So the semantic web stuff that we saw was about description logics, which is the logic of concepts, subconcepts, properties, and subproperties, something that is very closely related to object-oriented programming in spirit, right? So you're asking about those classes and, for example, try to reason about, is something a subconcept of something else, right? That is comparatively easy because the subconcept relation is transitive, but there is other more complicated problems. And if you speak of more operational logical things, for example, employing logical programming, Horn logic, then you would run into all the vast amounts of results from the 1980s from symbolic AI, right? And there is application fields such as recommender systems, the stuff that Wolfgang does in his lecture and so on. So it's a vast field. It doesn't cover anything there, but you would have to know a lot of these aspects, right? Which makes it so hard to come up with a consistent lecture on social computing, because you can only sneak into every of these fields. And in essence, it would be... Yeah, it's an almost impossible endeavor to really come up with something consistent, right? That's why you cannot do that as a lecture in linear algebra, right? In linear algebra, you start with numbers, real numbers, natural numbers, and then you say what is a group, what is a vector space, what is a field. From a perspective of teaching, that's more easy. Since social computing is such a vast field, it's a bit harder to come up with something consistent, right? I'm still trying, okay? Good. So, question is, what is social computing? Again, I play back the ball to you and make up your mind what you think. What is your definition of social computing, right? Good. So far about that. As always, there is citations. There's a recommended reading. So in each slide set, I have these three approaches, as I told you. So minimal approach would basically be study the slides. Standard approach is study the slides plus read the background reading, right? And I'll have to put online the stuff of that. So if I don't do that, please remind me. And there is something for the fictional interested students, which there is some additional reading. Then there is the questions, right? And these, again, are the questions that I take 40% off out of for the exam, right? So if you really want to prepare for the exam, I know that you're not going to do that right now, but if the time comes, try to answer those questions, try to discuss these possible solutions with other students, and try to network your knowledge, okay? Good. So, let's switch to a more concrete subject, okay, and that is social network analysis, okay? Good. So, having said all about of these things about social context and especially long-term social context, so what can we do with social networks? And as I said, social network analysis is a field with a long tradition. Okay, so that was what we had, right? So we had graphs. And the question is, what can we learn of these graphs? Okay, so I'll give you two examples of, applied social network analysis problems, right? One is strength of weak ties, and the other one is 6 degrees of separation. So these are two examples to get into the mood for these things, right? Good. So what's strength of weak ties? So that is foremost a title of a paper by Granovetter, and he did a study on job finding. Okay, that was his example case. Okay, and what did he find out? So it is often the case that the weak ties provide more interesting knowledge, more opportunities than the strong ties. Okay, and that seems a bit paradoxical. Why is that? Yeah, well, you'd expect that your best friends have more to say to you than your not-so-good friends, okay? And one possible explanation is that the communication with your close peers, your close friends or your mother or your brother or something is certainly more frequent, right? So this corresponds to the fact that the inclination, if we view that as a valve system, right? So the inclination of the valve between you and, let's say, your brother, if you like him, right? There is also hate relations among siblings. So the inclination is not very steep, right? So you know everything that they know. And the same is true for your good friends. So the valve might have a large diameter, so you have a high amount of trust and you would tell your brother probably everything, but you've already told your brother everything, right? So there's not much to say. In contrast to people which you hardly know, because there's a more steep inclination in the valve might have a smaller diameter, so there's not as much trust among you, among a stranger and you, but the stranger might have to tell you more interesting things, okay? Now, why is that a finding of social network analysis? Well, first of all, we need to come up with an assessment of tie strength. So if you want to reason about whether these effects are actually true in social media, you'd have to come up with such an estimation. And, for example, in one study we tried to assess whether there's a Granovetter effect, for example, on Twitter, right? And that's a typical study of social computing that you could find at those conferences, for example, right? And another thing is, for example, if that is true, can you make use of that for recommender systems or social information retrieval? Because if you have a lot of connections, especially in your friend-of-friend range, you would have to rank your search results. And would it be a good heuristic to rank it according to tie strength? Inversely so. Yeah, that's an open question. We don't know it. And that's why in the exercise we will try to analyze that here in the class. Okay, good. That's strength of weak ties. This paper by Granovetter. What about 6 degrees of separation? Well, that's a more popular thing that you might have heard of. And I think I mentioned it. So this goes back a long time, right? So even 1909, people like Marconi investigated the number of radio stations which would be necessary to cover the whole inhabited world with radio transmissions, right? At those times, radio transmissions were the big technological thing, right? And you could find similar problems with Wi-Fi repeaters these days, okay? And what could be found is that any transmission would need about 6 such stations. Okay, good. That's one finding. Well, in the 1920s, there was this Hungarian writer, I think he was, I'm not so sure if he was a science fiction author, or if you could call someone science fiction author back in the 1920s, and he took up this idea of 6 degrees separation in the social network field in one of his stories, right? So do you know everybody, does everybody know everybody else via 6 degrees at most? And more importantly and more famously, Stanley Milgram came up with a so-called small world experiment. And that was in the 1970s, if I'm not completely mistaken. So what did he do? He wanted to verify and investigate this claim of, well, measuring the diameter of the social network in a certain geographic area, in this case in the United States. And what did he do? In his small world experiment, he sent packages to certain people. I think they were randomly chosen. And in those packages, there was an instruction and a pack of postcards. And that instruction read, please try to send this package to a certain person. And the person was known by several characteristics, for example, the profession, but not in a way that you would look it up in some white page or postal record. It was send it in the direction to that you would think is closer to that person, right? And if you do that, please use one of the postcards to report back these stations, right? And the next one would get the package and would continue forwarding it to someone that he thought would be closer to the recipient. And finally, the recipient would receive the whole thing and would also send a postcard back for to them to control the experiment, right? Obviously, there was a big loss in postcards and a big loss in those packages. Not everybody responded, but on average, it turned out to be the case that there were less than 6 such stations necessary to reach this completely unknown person, right? And he even geographically distributed his packages, such that it has also implications on the geographic distribution of social relations, which we will not discuss here, right? And, well, the average path length was about 6. And people used different strategies to actually route, right? So you can route according to geography, right? So if I'm living in Los Angeles, and if it's known that the person that I need to address the package to lives in Boston, and I have a friend, let's say, that lives in Tampa, Florida, and another friend that lives in Seattle, who would I choose? Well, the simple heuristic is I would choose the Florida guy because it's much closer to the East Coast, right? Seattle is in the northwest, whereas Tampa, Florida is in the southwest. And you need to address it to Boston, which is in the northwest. Okay, so that's geographical routing. Then you could also come up with profession-based routing. I know that the recipient is a lawyer. Would I send it to my friend in Kansas who's a university teacher, or would I send it to my other friend in New York who's a pizza delivery guy? Well, New York is much closer to Boston, that's true, but the probability that a lawyer is known by a personally known by a pizza delivery guy is much smaller than that he's known by a surgeon, I don't know, right? And that's why you can have a lot of different of these routing schemas. And, this is something that has been tested in various ways, and it still turns out that social networks are typically networks that have a very small diameter as graphs, right? In the order of magnitude of 6 for the whole Earth's population. And this resulted in various interesting other experiments. So one thing is about the Erdős number, right? Did I tell you about that? No, good. So Erdős is a famous Hungarian mathematician. I think he published around 500 papers or so. So a typical math genius, right? So people came up with a co-citation network. Who published together with Erdős, right? And the Erdős number is the path length from a given researcher to Erdős, okay? And it turns out that these numbers are really small, even for people that publish in fields that are only roughly related to the math fields that he worked on. And he worked on a lot of these fields. That's why people took him as a central figure, right? Well, again, a confirmation of this, of this 6 degrees principle. Now, people turned that into more, popular culture experiments by computing Kevin Bacon numbers, right? So Kevin Bacon, the actor, and the social network was built by co-acting relationships. So who acted with Kevin Bacon in a movie? Again, it turns out that almost all of Hollywood has very small Kevin Bacon numbers. Now, things become weird if you have the Erdős Bacon number, which then is built on networks of people that have acted and published, okay? And it turns out that people, on average, have small Erdős Bacon numbers as well. And that's really strange. Well, if you look at people like, for example, Natalie Portman, right? The actress. Natalie Portman, I think, and if let's take that the Erdős Bacon number is the smaller of the two, okay? And I think that she really has a Erdős Bacon number of 2, right? Why is that? Okay, obviously she acted with a lot of people, that's clear. But obviously she also has a bachelor in psychology, published a paper with her teacher, who has published with someone that has also published with Erdős. So we see it's a small world, right? And the small world phenomenon is even, it's even a mathematical theory that we will investigate by Watts and Strogatz, who published a Nature paper about this. Because the question is, how do you build a random graph that has these social network properties? Small diameter plus high clustering coefficient. We'll see what this is in a second, right? So a more thorough math investigation would lead to random graph theory, and in that random graph theory, we have that small world graph thing that Watts and Strogatz published, I think, in 1998, surprisingly late, right? So what is a clustering coefficient? So we know small diameter is this 6 degrees of separation thing, right? So the diameter of the graph is the maximum path length of any two pairs of nodes, right? So the clustering coefficient, well, as it says, measures how clustered a social network is. So first of all, we need to define that on a node basis. So what's the clustering coefficient of a node? So if you look at undirected graphs, this is given by that simple expression, right? So it's the quotient of, for a given node, right, what is the maximum number of connections this node can have, right? It's the node's degree, right? Or no, different, right? Good. So let's do this with the chalk, right? If we have a node, right, and the node has an ego network of people that this node knows, right? When would we say that this node lives in a clustered environment, okay? Certainly not if none of his friends are connected, right? Because that would correspond to a person that has a lot of friends, but those friends don't have anything to do with each other, right? So that would correspond to a very low clustering coefficient. Now, if these people know each other very well, right? And the extreme case would be a clique, a fully connected graph, then we would say that this node lives in a highly clustered environment. So it has a high clustering coefficient, right? So if the node in question has a degree of D, the maximum number of connections within the set of his friends would be d times d minus 1/2 combinatorially, right? That's the maximum number that he could have. I'm always talking of he, sorry. A she is always included, right? And this is set into proportion to the actual number of edges where the nodes are in the neighborhood of I, right? So this is the actual number of edges. That's why we have a set cardinality here. And this is set into proportion to the maximal number, okay? So if there is no connections at all, we'd have a very low clustering coefficient. If there's a lot of connections, we have a high clustering coefficient. And the same could also be done for a directed graph. Well, then you would leave this division by 2 in the denominator, obviously, because you do not count things twice, because you would have to see that this would have to be complemented by this in the extreme case, and this would have to be complemented by this in the extreme case, right? So that's why we are not having this division by 2 for the directed case, right? But that's really the same. And it turns out that it's very easy to come up with a random graph that has a small diameter. So you don't need much. So very simple random graphs would just say, build a graph by randomly distributing edges over the set of nodes, right? And if you do that, you would find that it doesn't take very many edges to really come up with something that has a small diameter, right? But what is very hard to build is a network that has a high clustering coefficient at the same time as a small diameter, right? That's surprisingly hard. And that's what the endeavors of Watts and Strogatz were, and why they are so famous, because they came up with a model for that. Now, it is clear that clustering is a property of social networks, because we tend to live in groups, overlapping groups. And in those groups, we have a high cohesion, right? In groups, typically, that's what makes them groups. Everybody knows everybody else, almost, right? And we have an overlapping structure of those. That's why it's clear that in social networks, we have a high clustering coefficient. But as I said, it's hard to come up with this. And it's clear why this has to do with social network analysis. So you're having a graph, and you're interested in the group structures, okay? And this is important because, for example, let's assume you're a game designer, and you're having a social game, something like World of Warcraft. People interact, right? And if you want to rely on results from social network analysis, first thing you need to assess is my player network a social network, right? And in order to do that, you have to measure certain characteristics, the diameter, the clustering coefficient, and so on, right? So speaking of, the clustering coefficient of a whole network is obviously the average clustering coefficient of its nodes, okay? That would be one way to define clustering coefficients. And, well, that's why we study these things, because we can make use of a lot of interesting results for new social media and possibly also for social games. So, social network analysis, as I said, is a field with a long tradition. So it, and there's a lot of fields contributing to it. Sociology, anthropology, urban studies, math, even physics, right? So there is a surprisingly large community in physics that made a lot of interesting contributions, which we will see, computer science and economy. 19th century, there is this famous German sociologist, Ferdinand Tönnies, who came up with early results. For example, he distinguished two basic motivations, one that he called Wesenwille, other one Kürwille. This one corresponding to your core groups, right, that make up your core identity, whereas the one that you choose, as in German Erküren, right, back in the 19th century. This is more with respect to your goal or practice-oriented groups, such as firms and states, right? Well, early 20th century, Simmel investigated sociability of humans. Then in the early, in the mid-20th century, there was this famous American sociologist Moreno, who came up with the term sociometry as the quantitative analog to this qualitative reasoning about social relations, right? Then there was a bloom in sociometry until the 1960s, but naturally those people would be bound to investigating networks of very small size, right? So networks of small companies, of large families and stuff like that. 20 nodes, 30 nodes, this is already a large network for them, right? And these days we're in the pleasant position of having nodes of millions of degrees, networks of millions of nodes, right? And in the 1970s, people would start to formalize these things, right? So Barry Wellman, for example, wrote a book which has typically it has a purple cover. If you want, I can show it to you, which deals a lot with formal social network analysis, but from a sociologist's point of view, right? So it takes a lot of explanations to, for example, explain what degree-based centrality is. However, it's one of the past standard books about social network analysis. And now in the 2000s, we have a lot of people contributing, for example, Albert Barabasi and John Kleinberg, which are physicists. No, Mark Newman is a physicist. Barabasi, I know as well, right, is also a physicist, and they would deal with a lot of theoretical methods to come up with interesting insights, right? So let's start with our own view on social network analysis. And the first thing we'll investigate is centrality, right? So what is centrality? Good. Obviously, if you have a social network, the simple question you might ask is who's important in that network? Who's a central figure, right? So centrality formalizes the intuition that some nodes are more central, more important for the network than others. So what are interpretations of centrality? Right. Is it about influence? Is it about prestige? Is it about control? Or is it heavily required for information flow? What is it? Okay, good. So to give you an example, right? If persons vote for a leader, right? And if the edge semantics is that U, V is an edge if you voted for V, then the winner, the most central node in the network, is the node with most in edges, right? So that gives rise to a very simple centrality concept, and that's degree-based centrality, right? A node is more important the more adjacent nodes it has, okay? If you have another edge semantics, for example, the edge semantics that we have an edge if U has convinced V to vote for U's favorite, which is called an influence network, then the node with the largest out degree is the most central one, right? Because he's the most influential person. That's for directed networks, right? You could just count, if you have an undirected network, just count the degrees and you'll have a measure, right? Another example would be bottlenecks or cuts and cut-based centrality measures. If a graph can be split up into two subgraphs where there is only very few connections between those two subgraphs, obviously the nodes that lie on these paths between those two subgraphs are very central. If there is a semantics that is according to the flow of information, right? If there's anything flowing in the graph, information, influence whatsoever, you're very central if you're on that bridge, on that bottleneck. That's also clear, right? So this gives rise to things and concepts such as betweenness centrality. If someone is on paths, on a lot of paths, on a lot of shortest paths, for example, then he or she is central. Good. Other variants are, for example, someone is important if he has a lot of important friends. Okay? This is something that we can also formalize, gives rise to an eigenvalue problem, and Google made that famous. It's called PageRank, right? So a web page is more interesting if it is linked to or linked by other interesting web pages. So this is a reflexive definition, which then gives rise to this eigenvalue problem and to the whole family of feedback centralities. We can also ask about the centrality of edges. So it's not only bound to nodes. We can also ask, what is an important social relation or a central social relation? Good. So, obviously, we need to be more mathematical. So, centrality indices are structural indices, meaning that we need to translate our intuition of importance into a math notion. And a structural index should be, of course, invariant to something like a renaming of nodes. Okay? So it should not make any difference if I change the IDs of nodes. It just makes reference to the structure of the graph. So a structural index on a weighted, directed or undirected multigraph is a function which maps the nodes to the real numbers or the edges to the real numbers, and it is invariant to isomorphic mappings, right? So if we have two isomorphic graphs, and they are isomorphic if we have a bijection mapping the graph 1G to H such that we have an edge in G if the mapped nodes are also forming a edge in the other graph, then a structural index would be invariant to such isomorphisms that map graphs to one another, right? That means if I have a centrality index on the original graph, it must give the same values on the mapped graph, right? That's why we call it a structural index, okay? Of course, such a structural index induces a partial order, right? May even be a total order, right? Strict or non-strict, we don't care at the moment. But what we can say is that one node is more central than another node. And what's important is that we always want to interpret centrality indices and their values on an ordinal scale only. Right? So if I have one node that has a centrality value of 17 and another node, let's call it 2, that has a value of 34, what we don't want to say is that this node is twice as central as this node, right? This would be a ratio scale. We don't want to interpret that. Yeah? It's also, If there is a third node which has a centrality of 19, we also don't want to say that this is two units of centrality more central than this one. This would correspond to an interval scale interpretation, which we also don't want. The only thing that we want is to say that we have an order, and this order says that one is larger than 3 is larger than 2 in terms of node indices, right? That's all we want, ordinal scale. So on an ordinal scale, the only thing that you have is order relations. On an interval scale, you can also perform such things as plus and minus, whereas on a ratio scale, you could also reason about divisions and stuff, right? So typical examples of interval scales would be the temperature scale in Celsius, right? So the temperature scale in Celsius allows to make statements such as it is today, it's 2 degrees colder than yesterday. So that corresponds to plus and minus computations, okay? But it doesn't make sense to say that 30 degrees Celsius is twice as warm as 15 degrees Celsius. Just physically doesn't make sense. In order to have that, to have a ratio scale, you need to switch from Celsius to Kelvin, right? Degree Kelvin. Because that's the absolute scale, and 0 degree Kelvin corresponds to the physical state of having no thermal energy, which is not physically, which you can't realize, right? But only approach. And it really does make sense to say 100 degrees Kelvin is twice as cold as 200 degrees, or 200 degrees Kelvin is twice as warm, is maybe a better interpretation, right? So here we don't want that. We would just want an ordinal scale interpretation. Sorry. Good. So first let's look at a family of centrality indices that are based on distances and neighborhoods, okay? And what this corresponds to is a node is more central the more reachable it is in the network. Okay? So most simple of these are degree-based centralities. So you would say, we already had that, that the centrality is the degree of a node. Or in a directed network, you could distinguish between the in-degree and the out degree, right? So that's a local measure, right? So you would just have to look at the node's immediate neighborhood to estimate its centrality. This is in contrast to measures that incorporate path lengths, for example, because path length is something non-local. You would have to take the whole graph into consideration to compute centrality indices that take that into consideration. One application is, for example, in this direct voting case, right? Let's look at something other that is also a local measure based on distances and neighborhoods. And let's, for example, look at eccentricity. Example. So, if you want to open a new Aldi store somewhere, right? Where would you place it if the graph models distances, okay? So what you would have to do is you would have to solve the so-called minimax problem. So you would want to minimize, sorry, it's not about the Aldi store. It's about hospitals. Aldi store comes in a second, right? Forget about the Aldi at the moment. If you want to build a hospital, where would you position it? So obviously, a hospital needs to be built somewhere where even the remotest regions can reach it in a substantial, in an acceptable time, right? So you would have to minimize the maximal distance, okay? That is the problem you need to solve. And this can be mapped, for example, to a social case, right? If you want to have someone that wants to act as a mediator in a company, you need to make sure that this person is reachable by even the remotest co-workers with an acceptable social distance, right? Otherwise, a mediator would just be useless if nobody has this property, right? So this is the problem you need to solve, the minimax problem, okay? And let's assume for the moment that we are dealing with undirected and unweighted graphs, like the Facebook friendship, okay? Now, the eccentricity of a node then is the maximal distance, so D denoting the distance, of this node in question to any other node, okay? That's corresponding to that problem, right? And for trying to come up with a location for that hospital, you would have to minimize the eccentricity, right? So the more eccentric a node is, the less central it would be, right? So this is, for example, a graph where at each or at most of the nodes, we would denote their eccentricity values. So those nodes that are here have an eccentricity of 4, right? So this is still the definition. While, for example, this one is rather eccentric. And the more you move to the periphery of the graph, the higher the eccentricity values will be, right? So for a centrality measure, what you need to do is obviously you need to compute the reciprocal value, right? So 1 over the eccentricity. So a node is more central, the less eccentric it is, okay? Or in terms of the hospital, it's a more suitable location, a more central location for the hospital, okay? And these black nodes here have the lowest eccentricity, thus they have the highest centrality, okay? Good. So let's go back to this ALDI problem, right? So for the ALDI problem, it's not as important if there is one or two customers living in the far outback. It's more important that on average, people have a small distance to the ALDI store location. That's why you have to solve something else, right? In essence, you have to solve the minimal sum of distances, right? So you take into consideration a location U, and you compute this quantity here. So you sum over all the other nodes and compute the sum of the distances of that location U in question. And you would want to minimize that. If that's minimized, that's a good location for the ALDI store. And again, the social analog could be someone, a mediator, a coordinator. However, the heuristic behind it is slightly different, right? So you would accept that there are people in the company that this person doesn't really know very closely. But however, on average, it would be a good coordinator. Yeah, and in that graph, for example, these are the values of that quantity. And again, it is easy to turn that into a centrality measure by just computing the reciprocal value. And this then is called closeness centrality, right? Closeness centrality is just 1 over that sum of distances to all other nodes. Now, of course, computing the reciprocal value is not the only way to turn this sum quantity here into a centrality measure. So you could also come up with something that uses subtraction, okay? And this is a way to actually do it, okay? So in order to use subtraction, you need to have some maximal quantity that you can subtract the quantity in question by, okay? And that, in our case, is the diameter of the graph, okay? So if I would, for each node, say, how large is the difference between the maximum distance and the actual distance from you to that node in question, I could also come up with a centrality for you, right? And this plus one here is because of the normalization. So I would normalize this by the number of nodes minus one. This minus one is because I would not take myself into consideration, but all the other nodes, right? And I would do this normalization to get a value in the range of 0 to 1. Now, that makes it necessary to add a plus one here to have suitable extremal values, right? So that's only a technicality, right? Well, this only works if we have a directed graph, right? Because if we have a graph that falls apart into components, then we would have some of the quantities, some of those distance quantities that would become infinity. And then things would not work very well, because something minus infinity, well, it's hard, okay? Infinity doesn't, cause such a problem here, right? If we have a disconnected graph, however, some of the quantities would still be finite, but if we sum over all of them, then every such sum would be infinity, and we would have a centrality of zero, right? Now, good. So is that a problem? And the answer is no, it's not a problem, because social networks tend to be networks which have an extremely high probability of only having one component, right? And you may have peripheral nodes which have not yet connected to someone, but you would just leave them out, right? There is other ways that are described in the background reading that I forgot to mention. We'll say a word on this in a second. That make use of settings such as set the distance to zero if they are unreachable in a direct via a directed path, for example. But that's clearly problematic, because you're doing something that is against the intuition to just manage a math quantity, and that's not what we want. So speaking of the recommended reading, okay. So for each, you know that for each slide set, I have one recommended reading. So for the game slide set, I have the master thesis by Henry that we try to assemble and with all the basic facts about social games and games definitions. For the social media part, I recommend you a chapter of another book, which I will put online today. And for this part, I'm relying on a book, that's this book here, that is a Springer Lecture Notes on Computer Science book, which with a green cover. And this book has the nice property that the full e-text is available for free in the library, right? I will put online the respective chapters on Piazza as well, so that you have them. But you can access anything via the web, right? And this book was written on a Darkstuhl seminar with heavy participation of guys from Professor Meyer's chair, right? So there's a chapter by Hanyu Teubig, there is another chapter by Sven Kosup, who's now a professor at Uni Konstanz, is also a theory guy that works heavily in social computing, right? And this is very well written, and for those that have a more mathematical interest, they can read these things there, right? So this is something I will show you next time how this book looks. Good. So these were two measures, eccentricity-based centrality and closeness centrality, that are all based on distances and neighborhoods, right? So is there something else that we could do, right? Well, we can also come up with something that's called centroid-based centrality indices, right? So let's assume, again, we have an economic setting. We have two competitors that have stores, or want to open stores, and want to choose a location for their stores, okay? Let's further assume that customers will make the choice whether they would go to one store or the other store solely on the basis of geographical distance. Now, the question is, how do I select the location for my store? And the social analog would be, can I find an ecological niche for myself, right? Where would I position myself? So would I want to be like a gothic or a rocker or a hipster? And that's something you would have to take into consideration. Are there more people in that sub-community? How far is the distance to other sub-communities? Am I compatible with other people, the way I present myself? So this is something that's roughly comparable, right? So let's denote by gamma u of v the number of vertices that are closer to u than to v. gamma UV is the number of vertices closer to U than to V. So, if I'm salesman number one and I select U as a location, and you're the competitor number two and you select V as a location, how many customers would I get? Right? So obviously, all those that are closer to me, U, than to you, V. These would I get. And of those that are on the boundary that are as close to me as to you, I would get half of them, right? And that's this expression here, okay? If you would think of this, this is just those that are as close to me as to you, okay? And if you further simplify that, you would see that this is the share of customers that I get, okay? Good. So what the competitor will do, so you, via choosing the location V, you would want to minimize my share of customers. And since this is a constant term, you would want to minimize this expression, gamma UV minus gamma VU. Okay? This is what you want to minimize by choosing a suitable V. Again, and this is typical game theory thinking, I know that, so I would choose my location U in advance such that I can calculate the worst case, right? So for all locations U that I could choose for my store, I would calculate what is the minimum of this FUV. That would be the worst case for me, right? And I would obviously choose a U that would maximize my profit, okay? So, and this C of U we call centroid value, and that measures the advantage of my location U compared to other location. Or in other words, what's the minimal loss of customers if I choose U? And the other one would then choose V according to this strategy, right? So, we could come up with centroid-based centralities. And that's a simple example here. These are the centroid values for the respective nodes. And we would see that node number one is the best choice, right? So node number one is the node that is most immune against the competitor's destructive strategy. Because if I'm located at the node which has a centroid value of one, the other one just, well, what would he want to do, right? He would just place his store somewhere on the opposite edge, but I'm comparatively safe, right? Because whatever he does, the competitor, he doesn't have the chance to spoil what I do in a substantial way, right? That's why I computed these things that he would do in advance. And that's why I call this a typical game theoretic thinking, because game theory is not about optimizing something which does not have a strategy of its own. That's optimizing against nature. That's optimization and not game theory. But game theory is optimizing under the assumption that the other one also has a utility and also has strategies that he or she can choose. That makes it a lot more difficult and then gives rise to things such as Nash equilibria, which we will discuss later. Good. Now, these were all measures that were based on distances and neighborhoods, right? That's comparatively local or comparatively simple. Now, what is with non-local measures of centrality? And the first thing that comes into mind is shortest paths as a modeling glue to come up with centrality values, okay? So, well, let's look at the possibilities that we have. Okay, so in this section, this part, we will only have, we'll only discuss this with undirected graphs, but they can easily be transferred to directed graphs. Okay, in order to come up with a centrality measure that's based on shortest paths, what we would need to do is we would need to solve the all pairs shortest path problem. So you all know that from GAD, right? Possibly so. And we talked a lot about these things in GAD. I was a tutor several years ago, so I think we still do there. So let's assume we know the solution to APSP. For example, by applying the Floyd-Warshall algorithm, which has a complexity that is cubic in the number of nodes. There are other possibilities, right? So if you have only unit edge weights, you can, for example, apply repeatedly breadth-first search. So a breadth-first search doesn't effectively solve the all-pairs shortest path problem, but if you have a simple implementation, why not? I mean, if the graph is still comparably small, you could use that. So breadth-first search solves the single source shortest path in a simple complexity, O of number of nodes plus number of edges. That's a typical manageable complexity in graph theory, right? So what is, well, the plus indicates that the algorithm's complexity is dictated by the number that is more, well, has more impact, which is usually the E, right? Because E is in O of V squared, right? Well, if you have non-unit edge weights, positive non-unit edge weights, breadth-first search is not of use, right? So then, for the SSP problem, you would have to use something like Dijkstra. And Dijkstra has a slightly higher complexity, O of V log V plus E, right? If you use efficient bookkeeping data structures such as Fibonacci heaps, right? For the all-pairs shortest path, Floyd-Warshall is a simple dynamic programming approach. So for each pair of nodes where you know the shortest path, you would consider intermediaries and then constantly update your estimate, your current estimate for the distance. And you'll do that for all nodes, and that is something that dynamic programming is used for, or in other words, Floyd-Warshall is a example for dynamic programming. However, it has the advantage that we can use arbitrary weights, even negative weights, but we must not allow negative cycles, because negative cycles are something that you can use to pump, right? So if you constantly revolve around negative cycles, you would travel to minus infinity. And if you look for shortest paths with respect to weights, then, well, minus infinity is the shortest path you can get, right? So this is something that you may not allow, but the Floyd-Warshall execution detects the presence of such negative cycles. So this is a candidate to use. But there are others, Bellman, Ford, and I think there's even more efficient ones that are introduced in GAD. So you'd have to somehow solve the all-pairs shortest path problem. So for each pair of nodes, you know the length of the shortest path, right? May they be weighted or not. Good. So the most simple heuristic that we will look for today, and this is the final centrality index for today, is stress centrality. Okay, and stress here is to be taken really literally. If a node is on very many shortest paths, then a lot of stress is exerted on that node if you assume that communication flows along shortest paths or any other resource that flows along shortest paths. Okay? So much information will run through that node. Okay? Good. The social analog is clear. People that are asked to contribute to workflows a lot. So the typical Linux expert everyone runs to. How would I do that, and do I have to set it in etc bin user home / dollar blah blah, or would I do something else, right? These are the people that are very popular on the one hand, but have a lot of stress. Okay, so a vertex is more central the more shortest path it lies on, or the more shortest path run through it. So then notation is sigma AB of V is the number of shortest paths from node A to node B that go over telephone, that run over node V, right? So, obviously, this number can be larger than 1. If there are more shortest paths that use V, right? So there can be paths from A to B that have a length of 8. There can be like 5 of these, and they all run through V. So sigma AB of V would then be 5. So the stress centrality of a node, or to compute the stress centrality, we have to average over all A and B. Or in other words, sum over all A and B, and sum up this quantity sigma AB of V, right? This would give a good, in this case, unnormalized stress centrality index, okay? Good. And the same can be said for variant for edges as well. You would just have to substitute the V by an E, okay? Now, set was the last one. Let's extend it to this one. This is a very famous centrality index, a very important one. So I'll repeat that next time, but for today, it's worth considering it already, right? So the only difference compared to stress is that now we don't have sigma AB only, but we will divide sigma AB by sigma AB, which does not rely on V, right? So we would normalize the number of shortest paths from A to B that use V and set this into proportion to the total number of shortest paths between A and B, right? So let's assume there are 5 shortest paths from A to B that use V, and there are 15 shortest paths from A to B in total. They all have the same length, okay? Because otherwise there couldn't be 15 shortest paths, right? This is only a very exotic case, but let's assume that. So then this delta would be 5 over 18, right? And this has some interesting effects, as we will see, right? What is appealing about that in contrast to stress, which just counts and doesn't normalize, we could interpret this delta AB as the probability that V is involved in a communication between A and B, right? Because it's something in the range of 0 to 1. That's why we can interpret it as a probability. Good. So the shortest path between this centrality is 1 by summing over all A and B and over this quantity delta AB, which is just that normalized sigma. Okay? Good. Well, interpretation, the control that V exerts on the communication in the graph, right? So if everything runs over V, then this delta would be near to 1. If V is only on some shortest path, but most of the stuff runs by V, then V doesn't control the communication. Okay? There is a comparatively new algorithm by Ulrich Brandes, which is also a professor at Uni Konstanz, and he's also involved in network analysis very heavily, also a theory guy, very famous, very reputated, and he came up with an algorithm that has, well, roughly a complexity in the order of magnitude of V to the power 3, and this is the exact term, right? And this is the algorithm that's still state-of-the-art for computing this shortest path between us. So what's the great advantage of shortest path between us compared to stress? Well, the answer is that shortest path between us formalizes centrality in a much more natural way than stress, okay? So let's look at those two graphs. And let's compute the centrality of the gray nodes for each of the two cases. Okay, so for the stress centrality, which we would denote as C underscore S, again, remember, we would just have to compute the sum over all pairs of nodes and compute all the numbers of shortest path that this node is on, right? So how many shortest paths are there in that graph from each node to each node? Well, that there are 8 over 2 such paths, and that's 28, right? So the stress centrality of each of those gray nodes is 28, okay? Now, the shortest path between the centrality, we would have to divide this, the total number of shortest paths that the number of shortest paths that use the node in question over the total number of shortest paths that are there, right? So this would introduce a factor of 1/3 in this case, right? So there are a lot of shortest paths, let's say from this node to this node, for example, this shortest path of length 2, that don't use this node, okay? So that's why, since there are 3 of these, we would have 1/3, a factor of 1/3, okay? Now, for this graph, the stress centrality is computed in the exact same fashion, right? So we would still get 28 for each of the gray nodes, okay? Now, the shortest path between the centrality, again, we would not have anything to divide by, so it's also 28. So it's a factor of 3 larger than the shortest path between the centrality for that case, right? And that's much more intuitive. So stress is the same, which is not intuitive, because intuitively we would say that in the upper case, each of those gray nodes is only responsible for 1/3 of the communication that runs from each of those two node partitions, or each white node to each other white node. Whereas in the lower case, we would say that the gray node bears all of the responsibility. And that's captured by shortest path between us, while it's not captured by stress. And that makes it interesting, and people use shortest path between the centrality, for example, for computing communities in networks, right? So that's the Gerwin-Newman method that we will look at in an upcoming lecture. Okay, so that's it for today. So we'll meet again next Tuesday. See you. Bye.